Marshall and Sagar here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Hey everyone, we have a special episode for you today. We know that everyone has heard the talk of, oh, Sagar's moving, he can't make this episode. A few weeks ago, I made a reference to Sagar not being there during the intro, and Phil, our producer, texted me and said, has Sagar actually not moved yet? So, yeah. This episode is an episode, if you are listening on audio, that you should definitely be watching on YouTube too, because you see a preview Sagar's amazing new studio in his home. Sagar, real quick before we get into the Q&A and the episode interview attached to this, what's the deal? What's this background? What's
Thank
cool
you.
There?
Yeah. So this is what I've been working on, everyone. I know it's been a gigantic pain. Trust me, I suffered probably much more than you, but we're here. We actually have a place in my new place where I can film, which is set up properly, which has correct lighting, which has a place for my books behind me. Been in long pursuit of something like this. Behind me, I've got some stuff I got from an antique store. This is a U.S. Army truck, which I found. Obviously, you guys know some of my books. I've talked about those in the past. This is a globe which still has the USSR on it, which is timely. For our current discussions. There's some other knickknacks, trinkets, and stuff back there. I'm sure I'll be rearranging. I still haven't put them in presidential order yet, which is annoying me in terms of my biography. But this is the best I could do for everybody after having moved.
I'm just excited that we could prove that this is all real and actually happening.
Yeah.
So here's the deal for this very special episode that we promised. We're going to do two things here. One, we're going to do an extended Q&A segment. People have been consistently writing in asking us to bring that Q&A in some capacity. So we're going to do that here. And then secondly, I was trying to hop on the news cycle and have an episode about Western China, Uyghurs, Xinjiang, all that great stuff. Unfortunately, the news cycle moved on very quickly. So it feels very out of date to have an episode responding to the Palihapitiya controversy that Sagar covered on Breaking Points last week. But who cares? You get a extended Q&A and you get an interview. So good stuff here. So quick shout outs. Plenty of books are we mentioned today. Check the bookshop. Subscribe to the Substack where people submitted questions. And of course, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. The person I'm interviewing, Jeffrey Kane, is actually a Lincoln Facet Fellow. This was the fellowship on emerging technologies that we advertised on the podcast a few months back. So Rui is interesting to talk with him about his book, The Perfect Police State. Let's get to what people are here for, the Q&A section. So we're going to start off here with a very on-the-nose one. Sagar, I'll read the question.
Sure.
Then you go and we'll just switch off who goes first. So you're taking this first one. Dan writes, what are your thoughts about audience capture and how you plan to avoid it? Audience capture being defined as having found a comfortable number of people paying fans that think a certain way and don't want to upset them by challenging their views and immediately losing revenue.
Oh, that's a fun one. And I can tell, one of my particular favorite critiques of either this show or Breaking Points is that it's been audience capture. I could make so much more money if I was actually willing to do that. I'll give you guys a perfect example, a little behind the scenes Breaking Points preview. Marshall, you can go ahead and guess. What was our highest canceled month? For what reason? Which issue area do you think for Breaking Points in the 7 months of its existence?
This was late August into September during Afghanistan coverage.
Because of Afghanistan, right. Do you know how much more money I could have made if I was like, oh, well, Joe Biden didn't do it right. And Trump
the populist case
awesome.
For staying in Afghanistan.
Yeah, it's like, and actually I violated all the things I believed just to dunk on Biden. I could have made way more money. A large portion of the people who initially wanted to pay wanted to hear that. And it cost a lot of money. I literally don't care. Same thing whenever it comes to this show. We could get way bigger by what? Talking about anti-vax bullshit all the
Let's
time?
Say we'd have the Weinstein brothers on every other day.
Yeah, we could have the Weinstein bros on. I'm not saying they're anti-vax bullshit or whatever. I'm just saying we could do this, you know, the case, lab leak, et cetera. Look, I do all that stuff, sure, but I also do a lot of other stuff. So that would be my main response. I just think it's so funny when people don't understand what the actual dynamics of this look like. And I mean, look, at this point, it's just so far gone. I'm not Dave Rubin over here. I mean, that's what it actually looks like. That's what actual audience capture looks like. Or frankly, I mean, look, I like the Young Turks in some respects, but they look that way too. They're just pretty much mainstream Democrats. And so, you know, you want to see what actual cultivating and being captured by your people look like. You look to those two examples for right and left.
Yeah, that's a great answer, Sagar. And yeah, it was crazy during the, because I co-hosted the show Breaking Points that period. Right. It was really frustrating. It was honestly depressing, to be honest, how you have this message with the show of, hey, let's not just see what Fox, MSNBC are showing. It revealed that there's a segment of anyone who, by the way, is still listening this far to either show is not in this category. So I'm not meaning to slight anyone, but there was a real part of the audience who signed up at first. And these are the people who canceled, who just, their problem isn't that MSNBC and Fox exists. Their frustration is that they want their own. So they wanted populist propaganda hour. And it was depressing seeing that that market exists. And obviously someone is going to come pick that up. But look, the actual answer here is that, and this is semi-pretentious, so I want to put this delicately, what are you trying to do here? I mean, I was reading this book, and the book made the point that there was some intellectual professor in the early 20th century who thought, like, my job as a professor is to pursue truth. That's what your calling card is. And on this podcast and on Breaking Points, dude, you and I are super privileged, not even in the woke sense, but like, we get paid to talk to smart, interesting people every single day. Like, that is at a core level all that we actually do. So by doing that, we then have a responsibility not to just sell out and do it for clicks. And having that North Star, understanding how cool it is that we get to do this, is the way that I personally avoid having this turn into the COVID vaccine lab leak hour, which, as you know, would make us much, much, much bigger than we are now.
Let me also say this. Been in this game for a long time. And I know that, again, sounds pretentious. I am only 29, but it's a young man's game out here on the internet, YouTube, and all of that. And, you know, I remember what people were saying 5 years ago. I've been an actual consumer of these things. And I also know, for me, having been on the other side of the microphone, to say, when I see somebody just go down that rabbit hole, man, my listener consumption of them or respect for them, especially over time, when I start to track 5, 10 years, just goes down dramatically. And so I want to set that example for my audience currently, to be like, you can put me up, myself up against me 3 years ago, up against now. And if I may be different, but I'll have explained to you why. I'll be like, this is why I think what I think. This is my kind of my own evolution of thinking. I do a monologue every 6 months or so talking about stuff that I've gotten completely wrong. Most of these people don't do that. That's one of the number one signs of audience capture. So that's just something to say, which is, if you've been in the game long enough, you know that the people who survive and make it for the long run, per your point, what are we trying to do here? Well, mine is, I want to be in the game for a while. And, you know, you can make a lot of money in a short period of time, but if you want to do it month after month, year after year, and grind, that's a whole other story.
Yeah, don't forget, Sagar, we literally spent a couple of weeks last fall pointing out that our first season was wrong. So that's pretty unique.
Right.
Next question. This is going to prompt a bit of friendly disagreement from you and I. Brad writes, hey, big fan of the show and longtime listener. I need some clarity on the Ukraine conflict. I'm very much in favor of restraint in terms of foreign policy, just to state my personal bias. Understanding Russia's deep ties to Ukraine and their fear of NATO takeover, however, can we assume this is a defensive measure in response to NATO expansion? Can you explain why this is obviously different than, let's say, World War II, where Europe adopted an appeasement strategy that backfired? Why would Russia's incursion be different from Germany's initial aggression? By the way, I heard this comparison on the MSM. I think it's quite silly, but I'd like to hear this hypothesis invalidated. Thank you. Okay, let's keep this one. I don't want to. Let's keep our responses shorter so we could go back and forth on this one, because there's a lot. There's a lot packed in there. So let's start with what I'm frustrated by in that question. Not in terms of what you are arguing, Brad, but a certain bit of like literal like Russian propaganda that just isn't true. I kept hearing this a lot of places, and I looked into it, and like NATO in the 1990s never promised the Russians that we would not expand eastward. You can look it up. Like, we could put show links there. Like, Gorbachev is on the record said, no one ever literally promised me that NATO wouldn't expand. Now, that isn't to suggest, as Sagar will no doubt cite, there were plenty of people in the 90s who said it was a bad idea to expand eastwards. But Putin's talking point that you promised me this and you lied to me just is not true. And frankly, even if it were true, at the end of the day, like just because some random State Department or official in the George H.W. Bush administration says something to a Russian official, unless there's a treaty, unless there's like an actual, like on paper, clear thing, that isn't how our foreign policy is run. Like I'm sure of it, you know, the FDR administration said all sorts of things to the Soviet Union that obviously, especially at Yalta and those big conferences, that the Truman and Eisenhower administrations didn't agree by. You can't just hamstring people like that. But that's like my initial reaction. But Sagar, let's get yours, then we can just kick it back and forth.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, Gorbachev is playing a little footsie there because there actually was a pledge in 1990 from James Baker that we would, quote, not expand one inch eastward. It was never codified into law, but in the original discussion, that was what was floated. So it's murky. That being said, I think it does matter. The reason why I will give that a lot of credence is, and I've been citing this a lot, George Kennan, the father of containment, specifically said post-fall of the Soviet Union that expansion of NATO eastward would provoke revanchism in Russia, rub it in their face at the fall of the Soviet Union, and produce the exact results that we have right now. But even a lot of this belies the point because it comes down to strategic interest in the year 2022. Do you quote-unquote do something or not? Now, for me, you and I are recording this. What's the date? Jan 24th, just things are moving quickly, so you don't know exactly. There was just a Pentagon press conference. Somebody came, Pentagon said, we're going on high alert, 8,500 troops to NATO, etc. Here's what I would just point you to. I disagree with it, but I'll tell you why. It's already failed. It is a failed policy. We did this entire script. We did it post-Crimea 2014. We did massive economic sanctions. We sent more troops to the Baltic states. We tried to do a united Europe. All of this, massive failure. The Europeans caved because they're addicted to Russian gas and anti-nuclear power for very stupid and idiotic reasons. So they removed the sanctions. The troops eventually were sent back and the NATO drawdown continued. There was actually a huge fracture in the NATO alliance of the French and German populations as to the hawkish stance towards Russia. And now we find ourselves still with the Ukrainian civil war heating up in eastern Ukraine, and now arguably even more of an international crisis. So at that point, then, in my opinion, you have two options. You can go full bore and you can extend Article 5 type like protections to Ukraine, which is not, I believe, in the strategic interests of the United States. Or we could try something different. I'm in favor of the different. I think we should have a much more diplomatic approach. And frankly, I don't think what Putin and them are asking for is crazy. A pledge from the United States that Ukraine is never going to be in NATO is completely fine by me. I don't even think the Baltic states should be in NATO. They are, but so that's over, but I don't think they should be. Same with Georgia in 2008. So your rebuttal, I'd love to hear it.
Yeah, I mean, several things. Like one, my funny contrarian take that started as a joke, but I'm increasingly being convinced by is maybe we should have just let Ukraine into NATO in the 1990s, in the sense that what are the two countries that Putin has actually invaded post-Soviet Union collapse? It's been Georgia and Ukraine. So it seems to me that we could obviously say it was a mistake to expand NATO eastwards. But from my looking at the historical record here, the only countries that he actually invades, therefore justifying, by the way, those countries' desires to actually join NATO in the first place, have been non-NATO aligned countries. So the real thing here, and once again, you're not doing this, I've watched your segments on Breaking Points, but I think too many people use the NATO 1990s argument to turn this into a blame America first thing instead of being like, oh, wait, like Vladimir Putin is a literal ex-KGB spy whose obsession since the 1990s has been reconstituting the Russian Empire, which was by proxy the Soviet Empire during the end of the Cold War. He literally has said the biggest geopolitical tragedy of the 20th century was the collapse of the Soviet Union. So anytime, and once again, you do this, so this isn't a call out for you, but anyone who says anything like, look, like we shouldn't back Ukraine, we shouldn't expand NATO, they have to start with the obvious truth that this is something that Vladimir Putin is starting. Like this is something that he is deciding to do at his own behest. He thinks he has an opportunity to take and exceed and advance his dreams, and that has to be really reckoned with. And then, too, I think the broader thing here is: look, no one No one is proposing bringing Ukraine into NATO. There were discussions about this in the 2000s after the Georgia invasion. That is obviously over. Georgia is never getting into NATO either. Putin has gotten what he wants. But I think the notion that Vladimir Putin, a like oligarch fueled, like tin pot authoritarian quasi dictator, he does not have the right to declare who is in what and who isn't in what. I'm just sorry. I just refuse to countenance that. Like, it's obviously like I'm totally fine with back channels. I'm totally fine if I have conversations around that. But like the notion that Joe Biden wants to admit or could even admit Ukraine to NATO is just insane and ultra bad faith on Putin's end.
But part of the problem is official NATO policy as of this day is that Ukraine and Georgia are still considered to be invited into the NATO alliance. And so this, again, this is longstanding bipartisan policy going back to the mid-2000s. And, you know, this is what I would point to, too. Yeah, I agree. Look, obviously, territorial conquest is bad. Like, we should not want to see this. But the European continental side, this is also what differs from Asia. The South Koreans and the Japanese want to spend a huge amount in their national defense and have domestic populaces which are terrified of China. They want the United States there as an alliance in order to do this. There's no evidence of that in continental Europe. In fact, right now, the most hawkish rhetoric on Moscow from towards Moscow is coming from Washington, from I always forget, what is the capital of Australia? Canberra, I think. Sorry, Australians. Canberra, yeah. And London, not actual continental Europeans. Paris, Brussels, and Berlin, the people with the most at stake here, arguably, in terms of power politics on the continent itself. It's a totally different situation. And also, I just think this is going to embarrass the West even more. I don't think Putin is dumb enough to actually annex the entire country of Ukraine. We're probably going to see some crime, in the words of Biden and summarized by Crystal, just the tip type style invasion of Ukraine, which is going to lead to a massive diplomatic gray crisis. And let me tell you something. I've seen the story already. Germany will fold. They will not care 2 years from now. And then the U.S. looks like it's the one who is pushing this as hard as possible, which is just an untenable situation when we don't share a border with them in the first place. So look, it's messy. I feel bad for the Ukrainians. I genuinely do. I don't think enough people say that either. You know, they are a separate people, but it's complicated. I actually wish more people were to actually talk about them and specifically what they want. Because, you know, Marshall, you were saying about NATO, not only half of them want to join NATO. The other half don't. The other half see it very much.
I wish Putin would listen to that point.
Yeah, but he will. Right. But he's got just as much. Right. Like he could point to the huge Russian speaking portion of Ukraine who love Putin and they want him to come in and extend Russian citizenship. And
I'm not accusing you of this, but this is a good pivot to the last part of his question, which is the World War II example. Hitler could also point. And I'm not saying once again, we have to be careful with this reference, but Hitler literally said, there are Germans in Alsace-Lorraine. There are Germans in Bohemia. There are Germans in Czechoslovakia. There are Germans, like the literal Sudeten Germans. That's what the whole crisis at Munich was all about. So to the last part of the question, we talked about this with Jonathan Katz. Obviously, and this is where Sagar's argument is strongest. We've gotten to this personally sometimes off the show in various signal chats. Invoking World War II during the 20th century and the first part of this century led to countless disasters. I think defending South Korea from communist aggression was the right thing. But basically after that, things get, insert Vietnam, insert not the first Iraq war, completely supportive of that.
Number two,
but
for
the
sure,
second though. Iraq war, you know, I'm sorry, but people opposing the Iraq war the second time around were not Neville Chamberlain, as many people on the right and center Rui said. But like that being said, the reason why we should focus on World War II in this example is World War II raises important questions that, Sagar, I think you can answer, but I don't think not enough people on your realist side can answer, aka questions of, okay, what is the line between encouraging aggression and accommodating legitimate critiques and legitimate problems? Hitler said the Sudeten Germans were being discriminated against and were in severe threat. Putin says the same thing with Crimea and the Ukraine. Therefore, when we're adjudicating these types of questions, they are simpler. An obvious question raised by World War II. If we say that what happens in Ukraine is effectively okay by not intervening, does that increase chances of a Balkan conflict, of a Baltic conflict with actual NATO? That is a World War II question. You can take whatever position you want on it. You and I may agree, may disagree, but that is why World War II, unlike in Vietnam, unlike in the Second Iraq War, is the proper space, for my opinion, to actually spend some time on.
Yeah, you know, this is a tough one. I don't know. Because I, in general, despise Munich comparisons because I just don't think they're helpful to exactly what you pointed to and have just been invoked so many times at this point. It's like that meme of it's like, Every conversation on the internet somehow finds its way towards Hitler. I've generally found the same whenever it comes to foreign policy. I think we should consider Russia and the Eastern Bloc in its own context. And a lot of people don't want to hear this, but it is empirically true, which is that the borders and the wars around this region of the world have been very messy for a much longer period of time. And as much as we can point to Germany and Sudetenland, it's very different. It actually doesn't have the same level of interconnectedness and part of being the Russian or the German Empire as compared to the Russian one. This goes back almost 1,000 years of history in terms of interchanging and changing hands between all of these territories. I don't think any of this is a good thing, and a lot of civilians and these people are suffering. I try to look at it in the much longer kind of stroke of history. And actually what's happening right now is an extremely typical, this is the funniest part about Putin, is he is the most out of central casting Russian leader that's ever existed. You could pull him out of the Romanov dynasty from like 1320. And basically they would have the exact same strategic calculus. I do think that considering it more in that context is important. And also to see, okay, well, what works and what doesn't in terms of the West? So this is where it's hard because it raises principal questions around the post-World War II international order. But I just frankly think that a lot of that U.S. ability to project power like that has degraded dramatically since the 1990s, and that we need to focus on our very key strategic areas, especially where the future is. I'm borrowing a lot of this from Elbridge Colby, which is Asia's the future. That's where I think almost 100% of American energy, economic optimism, and all more should be focused on. Europe has made it very clear that they're not in this with us, specifically continental Europe. I think the Anglosphere combined with a pivot towards Asia, unironically, not the Obama version of that, is the future. And that I just don't think a lot of this has any bearing on what that might look like. Although I think the Taiwan comparison is compelling.
Yeah, and look, last word on this is if you enjoyed our episode of Elbridge Colby back in September, that's actually a perfect illustration of something I was tweeting about last night, which is there's actually different camps here. Because the camp I'm just really annoyed with is like the generic, like the military-industrial complex, everyone wants war. Plenty of those people were not happy with the Bridge episode, but guess what? Bridge Colby holds your position and doesn't want to intervene in Ukraine. So please, the only position we are not going to be frankly very interested in is there's just this monolithic, we want to make Raytheon $100 more on their stock price generic take. There's actually a lot of really important nuance here. And my last word is basically, the number one thing that's going to drive me, we're going to cover this topic a lot in the next few weeks, is I want to live in a world where countries don't take territory through acquisition. That's just like the number one thing that's driving me there. Next question, spent a lot of time there, but I'm glad we could give nuance because we're going to do a lot of interviews on it. Chris writes, and this is a Sagar-centric one. Hello, Sagar and Marshall. I've been a relatively long-time listener of both Rising, Breaking Points, and The Realignment. I really appreciate the different perspectives you bring and find myself torn between your standpoints and my long-time libertarian philosophy. So, I ask this question with complete good faith and not as a gotcha or a purity test, Sagar. This is the only reason why I let this question through. Mm-hmm. Is Crystal Ball a communist at heart? And how do you reconcile working with someone who you disagree with?
I don't think she's a communist at all. I think Crystal is probably, I mean, you know, you should ask her. You can submit a Breaking Points question if you want. We can answer it over there. But two, she's pretty open as an FDR democratic socialist. I don't think that is communist. Am I missing something, Marshall? What do you think?
No. You're totally correct. Like and this is where, once again, we just did a segment where you and I disagreed on things. Something we agree on is I don't think the word communist has any use in modern American political discourse.
We except could dunk for people on, who actually self-identify as communists. Yeah, but right, sure, but even then, sure. They're so, usually
so
LARPing.
So fair, so you're like, right. So Twitter yeah. Twitter tankies who right. we can call them communists. But basically, put it this way. Unless you call yourself a communist, which Crystal does not, I will not call her a communist.
Yeah, same.
The thing that's interesting here is that if Crystal were actually a communist, I don't think you probably could reconcile yourself with her, because the whole point of Breaking Points is that at its best, the point is that two people who disagree on a lot of topics do have one shared question here. And I think communism, much as if, you know, I think communism just goes a little too far in a couple of different directions for there to be any shared ground there.
Yeah, that's funny. I'm almost stumped by it, because I'm like, it's just very clear to me that it's not a communist. You know, I have a suspicion that I know some of the people we might be listening to who are very annoying online and like to brand everything they don't like as communist. It's like my one thing I'll share with the lefties is like, can we leave some of the Red Scare, Cold War, like language alone? Like, what? You don't like bacon? You're a communist. Like, it's just like very annoying in terms of that rhetoric. So I think that's probably where you're getting it from. No, I think she's very open about who she is. I think she's a democratic socialist. She'll probably tell you that. But anti-woke leftist is probably the best description, Marshall, in terms of like on a quote quadrant or whatever. I think that's pretty much exactly where it is. And yeah, I mean, I honestly don't think she's that hard to pin down. So I'm surprised by the question almost.
Yeah, and look, the last thing that I'll add here is that, you know, I've co-hosted with Crystal before. I've had her on this show a couple of times. The thing I just say is the way that we can reconcile speaking with her is that that's the only way this country actually works.
Like,
well,
the
worst part of media today is just seeing all these, like, dude, you and I just totally disagreed on Ukraine and a bunch of big questions, but like, we still live in the same country. We still vote, we still do things. So it's actually very depressing. If you think about it, but someone's sort of like, Sagar, how can you sit next to someone who like disagrees on big questions where there's actually a lot up for grabs and it's not quite clear who's right and who's wrong?
Yeah, that's so weird. You know, I think maybe it's because I live here in the DC area where it's like, I'm around people that disagree with it all the time. Most of my neighbors and people I interact with in stores are mask liberals who force you to wear a mask even if there's no state mask mandate. In the state of Virginia. Okay, like whatever. You know, what am I going to be like, no, I do not comply or whatever. Like, that's just life, man. Like, you know, that's what it's like. It's okay. Not even to people you disagree with. I mean, I think it's probably healthy to just be around people who you're not 100% aligned with. If you are, that's actually a bigger problem. So I would turn it back around on you. Okay, what's the next one?
Yeah, totally. And by the way, thank you for the citation of our rule about good faith on the podcast. Oh, yes. No, seriously, thank you for noting that. And that's why I took your question, despite how contentious it is. Couple good questions from Victoria. We're a long, yeah, Sagar, I know you like these ones. We're a long way out. But what political narratives do you foresee for the 2024 elections or even the midterms?
Midterms are easy. Midterms are all about the pandemic. Unfortunately, I think the election will also be about the pandemic. And everything that is not technically about the pandemic is also about the pandemic, like inflation. Like gas prices, all that stuff. It all comes down to a single center of gravity, which is that the pandemic disrupted almost every aspect of Americans' life. The restrictions are making people miserable. People are also miserable for other reasons economically. The Biden administration seems intent just on not addressing those ever or during the day, which I find genuinely mystifying. It's funny, you know, I see people online like, why is Biden unpopular? It's like, well, he spends his entire time in office talking about stuff which is tangentially at best connected to the daily economic realities that people tell pollsters every single day that they're worried about. I have bad news for you. We are going to be arguing about masks on planes and stuff like that until 2024. And that is my very sad prediction. But at this point, I very much see that to be the case. Go ahead, Marshall.
Yeah, here's my prediction, and it's a disastrous prediction for the Biden administration. It seems to me, especially if Trump runs again, that the 2024 narrative is basically, and this, by the way, is the best case scenario for Biden if Trump runs again. Which do people hate more? What it felt like basically from November 7th until Biden was inaugurated. Mm-hmm. So just the worst parts of the Trump presidency. The exhaustion, the drama,
Yeah,
Rudy Giuliani, yeah, Rudy right. Giuliani, like bleeding right. his hair dye onto his face. Just actual, just like utter incompetence. I realize January 6th is controversial, but like that type of like event happening, just actual exhaustion. Do you want to go back to that? Or is that tolerable? Or was that an aberration? And frankly, Trump 2024 on would look much more like Trump from 2017 to pre the pandemic. That's basically what the Trump people would say. And all Biden's going to have, it's not going to be a positive case. It's going to basically be, look, I know things feel mediocre. I know that you're not particularly happy, but Jesus Christ, guys, you do not want to go back to January 6th, 2020, 2021. And I think that's a good, that frankly, I think that is going to be a real compelling argument for Joe Biden. Frankly, it's very compelling for me, but what an effing disaster given the opportunity, if that is what the argument comes down to.
And let me tell you something, Marshall, that ain't going to stick. I'll tell you why. The best thing that ever happened to Donald Trump was getting banned off social media. Political memory in this country is short. People barely remember how annoying it was to see some stupid ass tweet on TV and to be arguing about some Stormy Daniels or whatever. The pandemic actually was a big reset. Get it? In terms of it was a big reset for people's thinking and more, and it dominates so much of the conversation. I easily see a world where Trump doesn't win, but he wins big based upon a very simple message of make America 2019 again. That's a very compelling message to a lot of people. By the way, I'm not saying that's enough. I don't think it should be enough for our political leaders. But as you said, if that's the case to run on, and this is the case to run against, I'm going to bet on the latter one. All right.
Two more questions in our last bit. Victoria has another good one. On a global scale, America has always been a superpower benefiting off of a political narrative that we're the land of opportunity, equality, etc. Do you believe that narrative is changing? And if so, what is replacing it, especially with this idea of a realignment? Something that's really interesting, and this was covered in Frank DiStefano's book, The Next Realignment. We're actually going to have Frank on again this week. Everyone really likes him. We're using that as a bit of a, hey, you're new to the show. What's a realignment? What are we covering? Is the idea of the American dream didn't really become a popular narrative. Like even the coin wasn't the term itself wasn't even coined until basically the 1920s, 1930s. So that hasn't exactly always been America's narrative. What I think is currently happening is a lot of people worldwide are obviously skeptical of America. We've taken a couple of really big hits, Iraq war on the foreign policy side, the 2008 financial crisis on the economic American dream side. And then frankly, when it comes to COVID, just a societal discord and real government competence hit. All that being said, and this is going to, you know, be a rather obvious take for me, the Chinese Communist Party is doing us the favor of offering a competing model that can be compared and contrasted against. You can always see this in the polling. Despite everything that happened during those Trump years, which I was obviously like not a fan of, the U.S. is still up in terms of global perception relative to China. At the end of the day, people are going to see a 21st century where the big defining issue from my perspective is going to be the fact that, look, things are more decentralized. Top down doesn't work as much anymore. People, whether they're cities or states or individuals, are going to have more actual power. Idea I'm really interested in this book called The Sovereign Individual. Sagar, you've no doubt have seen this around Twitter. Yeah. But the basic point here is that which country is better equipped for a world where, you know, lowercase freedom is going to be more inherent. It's the U.S. And yes, we have all these debates about censorship. We have all these debates about COVID misinformation from the CDC. All of this contention going on right now, and this is where the realignment idea comes in, are our society fighting and working through it. This is what we talked about with Antonio Garcia Martinez about the 30 years war, like the equivalent of the printing press. But once we get through that, because we're optimists, we wouldn't be here if we weren't, we are going to have a society that's better adjusted to what people actually want than what China actually is. What do you think?
Yeah, it's funny. I completely agree with that, which is that, yeah, look, I mean, the fundamentals are strong. And as much as the chaos, it's funny because people will point to LA, San Francisco, Chicago. Business is booming. Florida, Texas, Arizona. You can't even buy a house right now, apparently, in Boise, Idaho. Like, America's a very dynamic place. A lot of the power is shifting because of the internet. I mean, I have some problems with the sovereign individual type theses, but at its core, like, they're correct about one thing, which is that whoever is the, especially with the internet, the ability to empower the person to actualize in the environment that they want, need, and can curate the most for themselves. And the biggest problem for the West is going to be trying to empower everybody to be able to achieve that future, as opposed to China, where they literally don't want that future to exist. And to the extent that it does, that they will control every single person at the very top. I have no question that we'll win on that front. I just saw an interesting post, hadn't even thought about it, is about whether Starlink, Elon Musk's internet everywhere.
Oh, is this Catherine Boyle's take?
Yeah, Catherine Boyle's
take. She came on the show back in July.
Who had been on the show before. Whether Starlink will be the best thing that ever happened to motherhood. The reason being that with the rise of remote work, you can have a Starlink connection literally anywhere. You don't even have the heat. You know, I just got internet here at my place. The Comcast guy had to come out and like string a wire. Like, you don't have to do any of
that. Sorry, can you actually explain Starlink
too? Starlink is it's a SpaceX effort in order to have high speed internet access, satellite internet anywhere with a receiver. I think they're going to be pretty much all across the US by the mid of 2023. And by high speed, I mean high speed enough to like watch Netflix, do a Zoom call. I think it's like 200 megabits per second. Not great, but you know, not terrible either. That actually could dramatically change the entire rural part of America. Rural broadband is one of the biggest problems that we have right now. Look, this can sound a little techno-utopian, but directional truth is powerful. Derek Thompson on this show said that if only 10% of white-collar working professionals move, that is the greatest internal migration in the United States since World War II. It doesn't take much in order to spark massive sociological change.
No, and I really appreciate what you said there, Sagar, because what you're also getting at is the fact that the big debate that we should be having right now is how much of this change is inevitable, how much it should be reconciled against, because something that you often hit is the fact that we told too many convenient stories about globalization. So, trade just naturally happens, so we have to basically leave Ohio behind, or things just happen, therefore people who look and act like us, and I mean that on a class level, not a racial level, are able to really benefit, while people who don't have our same privileges can as much as well too. When you were saying you're a little skeptical of the sovereign individual things, this is really the important place for us to end for this episode, because geez, like, let's just say sovereign individual is very convenient for like crypto billionaires and a lot of their anti-government beliefs. And we, as people who are trying to live in a society that's fair and balanced in the good sense of the term, should not just be saying, well, I guess cryptocurrency is destined to displace the US federal government, therefore, like, you can do whatever you want. We can't say anything to you. That is what a bad version of what we are articulating really here says. And actually, here's the last actual question here. This is actually an important one. It will be an easy one-word answer. Matthew writes, what are the best resources to learn about Russian history and culture?
Oh, wow. You know what? This is a fun one. I just watched this on YouTube. It is a nine-hour documentary series on the history of the Romanovs. So if you really want to do a deep, deep dive, it begins with the beginning of the Romanov dynasty and ends there. I'm trying to think about some of the best books. I read a book called The Russian Revolution. I forget who wrote it. It's one of the best books I've ever read. There was also a biography I read of Lenin. Here, I'll tell you what. Can we search these after the show, Marshall?
Yeah, because I don't know who wrote this. So look, guys, here's what we're going to do. We're going to put together a quick bookshop. We'll put it in the show links. You could buy it from us. You can check it out. That's all that. Hope you all enjoyed this Q&A section extended. Lots of good stuff here. We didn't get everyone's single one's questions, but we'll sprinkle the ones that came in throughout the next month or so everyone gets their fair share. Thanks for joining us. Now, on to the interview with Jeff Kane about his book, The Perfect Police State, and Xinjiang, Uyghurs, all that very not good stuff. Hope you enjoy the rest of the episode. Jeff Kane, welcome to The Realignment.
Great to see you, Marshall. Thanks for having me.
We were just chatting. We're a tiny bit behind the news cycle with the big debate about Uyghurs, Western China, and everything after Chamath Palihapitiya made controversial comments on the All In podcast last week. But I think it's a good opportunity to
dive into a topic a little deeper now that tensions have cooled a little bit. I really suggest that anyone take a listen to that episode beforehand if you haven't already, or listen to it right after this to get a bit on what the public discourse is. Let's just start at a very basic level. What is happening in Western China?
Western China right now is the site of what multiple governments have declared a genocide. So currently there are about 1.8 million people from ethnic minority groups in Western China who are predominantly Muslim, who are currently languishing in concentration camps where they are brainwashed, tortured both psychologically and physically, where they're forced to stay for years on end mostly, and to internalize and worship the dictates of the Chinese Communist Party. This is a situation that, you know, I had lived overseas for about 12 years. I was a reporter in China and other parts of the world, covering technology, covering governments. And I had been to this region of Xinjiang in Western China six times over the years. I had, you know, flown out from Beijing, the capital. I had seen this descent over about 10 years each time I went. And the last time I arrived there, which was in December 2017, I felt like I had stepped out of my airplane and I had walked out into a science fiction dystopia movie. It felt like I was, and this is no exaggeration, I felt like I was in the movie Minority Report, or, you know, George Orwell's 1984, to something like that. Just the place had turned incredibly heavy, dark. There was surveillance everywhere. I mean, I can't even count the number of cameras that I would look around and I would just see them watching me everywhere. I mean, we even sat in private places, me and my guides, and there would be like cameras pointed at us in private places, taking snapshots of us. And I know that because they would flash. They had a flash on them. You know, we'd be like having a tea, and like there would be a flash, and I'd look up and there would be like a camera pointed right at me. Not just cameras, but police pillboxes on every other corner. There was the language of warfare being deployed everywhere, that, you know, China was at war, that we have to stop the terrorist menace. And not only that, but there was one giant artificial intelligence system that is called the IJOP, or the Integrated Joint Operations Platform, which was gathering mass data on everyone through these cameras, through police human inputs, through people's messages on apps and their text messages, their phone calls, like what they buy at the local store, what they do every day, when do they leave their home, when do they come home. It was gathering data on all this and trying to predict whether people would become a terrorist or a criminal sometime in the future. So if it decided that they would become a terrorist, that they were at risk of this kind of thinking, the AI system would send a nudge on the smartphone of a police officer somewhere nearby this person and warn them that a potential terrorist was lurking nearby, that they should interrogate them, maybe knock on the door, check their papers, their ID, ask how they're doing, what's up. And then if something really does seem amiss, then that police officer has the authority without trial to take them away to a concentration camp. And these are the camps that I talked about earlier. So there are an estimated about 380 concentration camps. They're up in the, you could say, they tend to be more in the countryside, up in the mountains, a little bit more removed from society, but they can also be in the cities too. And these are truly terrifying places where, you know, I interviewed 168 Uyghur refugees and other people related to the Uyghur situation, who had, many of them had been through the camps. They had things to say that were just, scarifying and dark beyond anything I had heard. This was, you know, not Nazi Germany. This is, you know, this is not the gas chambers. This is not the death camps, but it was something else, because it was a total attempt to erase an entire population's identity its inner being, its psychology, to in the end erase that entire group just to turn them into the brainwashed minions of the Chinese authoritarian government. So that's why I wanted to write this book, because I saw that this was going to be a significant story. This is back when this was, the situation was just starting to happen, starting to grow. And I knew that this would be important for, you know, an important topic for the future of, you know, a lot of humanity, because I feared that this was what 21st century authoritarianism was going to look like. I really was scared that this might start to spread to other places and we might see, you know, this becoming one of the major stories of our times.
Obviously, you've traveled there, so I'm not questioning your experience, but because I read too many YouTube comments, I'm very aware, well aware of the fact that there is a bit of pushback to the narrative that you just said. Even during the All In podcast episode, Shamath Palihapitiya started implying and referencing that pushback. What are the critics, especially the Western critics, of the story you're telling saying, and why are they wrong? That's a very leading question, but I what I really mean by that is you obviously disagree with them. Why is that?
Yeah, no. That's a very good question. So there has been, since the first evidence started coming out, the first physical evidence in the form of satellite imagery and official Chinese government reports and you know, various reports in Chinese, first started coming out in 2016 and 2017, there has been a growing chorus of people who argue that the narrative is essentially the invention of hawks in the West, in America and elsewhere, who, you know, are trying to build a case either to go at war with China, to, you know, to try to curtail China's influence, to try to smear China as if China is some kind of, you know, actor that, you know, is not capable of some of these mass atrocities. So, so the thing is that, you know, both the argument and the evidence that they put forward is quite fallacious and spurious. And I'm trying my best to represent their argument in the fairest way. I mean, they truly do believe that these crimes and this genocide is not happening, that I think that they do tend to admit that maybe there is something bad happening in Xinjiang, but they argue that the story is wildly, you know, taken out of context or exaggerated. They admit that China, you know, is certainly, you know, not a democratic government, but what they're doing in Xinjiang is trying to, you know, they're oppressing people, but, you know, but not many people argue that, for example, they are, you know, most people are not outright oppressed, that actually life might be somewhat normal for most Uyghurs. And, you know, maybe there are some who are being taken to more extreme measures. And some of them also, so some of these people also argue that, you know, China actually does have to deal with a real terrorist threat. And, you know, it's taking even-handed measures to ensure that the population, you know, doesn't become too infected with terrorist ideas. So the thing is that the people who make these claims, they often act in bad faith in that they cite either Chinese propaganda reports that have come out of, you know, official Chinese state media denying the claims. Sometimes they cite, they sort of cherry pick studies or numbers. They might point to one study that said this, but then they ignore all the other data that's been published since then that shows that the concentration camps have expanded. These are the kinds of, I guess you could say, the kinds of claims that I have to, you know, as a author and writer on this topic, I have to, you know, address these claims almost daily from people who kind of bring them forward. So the thing is that, you know, if you were to go back and say, compare these atrocities with the Holocaust, which, you know, in terms of death, you know, was far more extreme. I mean, this is not the Nazi Holocaust. This is different. You know, when the Holocaust was first happening, there was certainly evidence of it. There were refugees who were coming and telling their stories. But the documentation we have today of this particular modern genocide far exceeds any documentation we've had historically from any genocide that I can, you know, look at in the 20th century. I've studied many genocides and many atrocities, and just the level of evidence that, you know, thanks to the internet and to, you know, open source materials and an abundance of translators who look at these materials and translate them, satellite data, Google Maps. We're now, you know, living in this world where regular people can amass evidence of crimes against humanity and effectively prove it. They don't, you know, they don't need to go through the, you know, the official sources out there to, you know, to document evidence of it. So one of the things that the critics overlook is that these concentration camps are entirely documented and entirely viewable on Google Maps. And we know that, so a number of expert analysts who specialize in satellite imagery have looked at these, you know, these compounds and looked at the sort of the official written reports, so official tenders that have come out from Chinese state websites, so that the government posts, you know, tenders, they're looking for contractors who can help build the camps. And they have confirmed that these are concentration camps, these are mass internment sites. And also, you know, there, I mean, that's one of the main pieces of evidence. But then we can also look at just the level of braggadocio that happens among Chinese companies, Chinese technology firms, and the Chinese Communist Party themselves when they write in their own language, when they publish things in their own language. So Chinese technology firms are often not concerned about, or at least in the past, this has changed more recently, but in the past, they were not so concerned with the implications of what they were doing. They were happy to, you know, post official statements online confirming that they were working in Xinjiang, that they were installing this many cameras, installing this or that in a concentration camp somewhere. The term they use is a re-education center or a detention center. And so they've actually shot themselves in the foot, and they've accidentally provided a lot of the evidence that has, you know, come out over the past few years that have now been reviewed by numerous governments. And this is the kind of evidence that has been used when governments do take the parliamentary action to declare this a genocide.
Yeah. On that note, you've said genocide a couple times. Help us understand, A, like what genocide means, and B, especially given the fact that, as you clearly stated, this isn't a question of the Nazi Holocaust of Jews and other minority groups during World War II, how do we basically place this within the historical scale of these sorts of like really horrible incidents?
So under international law, genocide has multiple facets, and there's no single broad definition of genocide that can be used to kind of create this umbrella term for every genocide. One of the key elements is the intent. It certainly helps to have, you know, evidence, you know, say in the form of statements by national leaders, military leaders, that they are trying to exterminate a group. And then one of the other big thresholds in this particular case is the existence of policies that force women to take, you know, sterilization products. They have to undergo forced sterilizations at local hospitals. They're called in, and also to take, you know, they're required by the government to take birth control if they haven't done that a lot of the time. And also they're encouraged to intermarry with the dominant Han Chinese ethnic group. This is also an effort to, you know, to erase sort of the Uyghur population. So when governments declare this a genocide, that is the sort of evidence that they're looking at. They're looking at the forced sterilization of women. They're looking at the intent of the Chinese government to eradicate Uyghur culture, language, history. One of the major elements of this genocide has been the destruction and the demolishing of mosques and other religious sites that are, you know, very core to the Uyghur identity. So you know, when governments declare this a genocide, they're not talking about, you know, the Nazi extermination of the Jews or the Khmer Rouge of Cambodia, who killed one quarter of the population based on their class, looking at wealthier and more educated people. They're talking about a more 21st century style of authoritarianism that is unique, that we haven't really seen before, and that actually, I think in some legal circles, is starting to call into question past definitions of genocide, and is starting to call for maybe a rethinking of what we consider a human rights atrocity. You know, maybe it's time to look at different elements of how this can happen. So getting to the second part of the question then, when you ask about the historical scale of what we're witnessing. So there's an excellent book by Ben Kiernan, who's the leading scholar of historical genocides at Yale, and it's called Blood and Soil. It's very dark and sad, but truly amazing, as much as a book on genocide can be, history of all the major genocides since ancient Sparta, when people who were considered weak or too poor from a lower class were exterminated systematically each year. So if you go through the historical story of genocides, it's really the 20th century that was the century of genocide. The Armenian genocide, under the Ottoman Empire today, which is where Turkey is, was, you could say, the precursor or the moment that, I think that people started to realize that this was going to become a feature of warfare and of authoritarianism for the century to come. The Holocaust was the high point, and then there were numerous, mostly communist-instigated genocides for the years to come. I think the major one is Cambodia after that, but there have been all kinds of...
And the reference to communism is the fact that the delineating factor was class versus the ethnic and racial ones of the first half of the 20th century. Is that what you're suggesting? Is that what that means?
So when I talk about Cambodia in particular, the second half of the 20th century, so the major genocide was really Cambodia, which was 1975 to 79. About 2 million people perished in that one. And it was mainly, it was a communist government that wanted to redial the clock back to year zero to create a classless society. And in the process, it's a system that consumed itself, because anyone who showed any level of being urban, or say wearing glasses or having a medical degree, even maybe being a bank teller, that sort of thing, signs of modernity, these people were exterminated to bring the nation back to, you could say, the agrarian paradise. That was the vision of Cambodia's Khmer Rouge. Not all genocides were communist, but I think that's the most pertinent example from that particular, the period of time, that the Cold War. But the biggest common factor in the 20th century genocides was the outright extermination through blunt force and blunt death killing of groups. In the case of the Nazis, they were very bureaucratic and sophisticated in the ways that they sort of invented ways to kill people. That's the best way I can put it. Very bureaucratic, cold, just you get a number on your arm, you go to the gas chamber, they exterminate you. In the case of Cambodia, it was a bit, you could say rawer. It wasn't, it did have a bureaucracy, but it was more like, people would, small groups of people would be marched to their deaths. They would be, there were ammunition shortages and all kinds of shortages. So they would just, hit them with a blunt object in the back of the head, throw them in the pit, and that was it. Different kind of genocide. In the case of the Uyghurs in particular, this is something that we haven't quite seen before, that's being called a genocide now by various governments, because there's no evidence yet of death camps. There's no evidence that, people are getting the number on their arm and they're being marched to the mass grave and just being exterminated outright. My educated kind of guess based on all my own research is that this, the past genocides just can't happen as easily as today, because we live in a well-documented age with the internet and smartphones. It's fairly easy for a smartphone video to be leaked if, something really bad is happening. And we have seen many leaks in the case of the Uyghur genocide. Many government documents have been leaked out to the outside world. They were supposed to be kept secret. They spread instantly because of the internet. So it's very difficult for any authoritarian government to keep those mass atrocities under wraps. And I think that might be one of the reasons why the Chinese government in this case chose, you could say, the softer route to what people are calling a genocide. The goal here is not to outright kill off the group, but the goal is to, it's much slower and it's more subtle. And the goal is to use novel technologies like AI and facial recognition, plus the concentration camps and the human policing, to force an entire group to subjugate their own beliefs, their own identities, their inner beings, their needs, emotions, their critical thinking, everything that makes them human. The goal is to subjugate them and to turn them into just outright robots or machines that are devoid of identity. They've internalized the demands and the needs of the authoritarian government, and their goal, their end reward is that, you know, they will supposedly be rewarded if they simply become Han Chinese citizens. Han Chinese is the dominant group.
And I was actually wondering this when I was reading the book, is it that they want them to be blank slate robots, or is it that they want them to integrate into the Han majority? Because those are technically two different things, aren't they?
They're technically two different things. They want them to integrate into the Han majority, but in the what I found from my own interviews is that in the process they became blank slate robots. They didn't adapt Han practices. They didn't really become Han Chinese people. And I still do have questions, and I think that more documentation will come out in the coming years. We're still in the very early phases of seeing the historical significance of this. But my own guess is that in reality, you know, in the end, maybe when this atrocity is completed, the Xinjiang region will look more like a place, you know, filled with traumatized machines, robot-like people who don't, you know, who just don't want to speak to authority, who don't want to deal with authority, who don't want to have a critical thought flourishing. I haven't found much evidence that they successfully transitioned to the Han Chinese way, so to speak.
Here's what I'm trying to understand here, and I really want to preface this by saying I'm not trying to victim blame at all here. But why would the Chinese Communist Party do this? That's a slightly stupid question in these contexts, because you could say something like, why would the Nazis kill German Jews? So it's kind of a silly question, but it's a serious question in the sense that, from my perspective, the sheer irrationality of it, the real serious impact on China's perception around the world, right? We could debate whether or not governments are doing anything. You could make the obvious point that Chamath is making, where he says, well, we're not going to do anything about it, and how much do people care? Well, people care enough that China's perception worldwide has collapsed during the Trump and early Biden years. So why, from their perspective, does this make sense? It seems like the knife attacks and the incidents of terrorism are not to the scale that would necessitate how much sheer soft power damage has been done to China because of this.
That's, you know, certainly not a dumb question at all, because I think what you've done is you've opened up the conversation to the big question, which is, you know, why a government like China or any government would undertake such an irrational course of action. They've done enormous damage to themselves in terms of soft power. The Olympics coming up. I mean, it's been devastating, just the level of vitriol in the world that now exists against China for its actions, you know, alarming actions over the previous 3 to 4 years. One thing that I think we always have to remember is that what is irrational to us sitting in America or a Western democracy, you know, what seems normal, what seems the correct way of doing things to us is not going to be what seems rational to a Communist Party official in China. One of the things that I've learned from my own, you know, work worldwide in these authoritarian regimes is that rationality has its own logic in other places. I think that rationality, it can be culturally specific and it can be specific to particular governments. I've also spent many, I've been to North Korea many times, I've been to other regimes, and going to North Korea as a good similar example to Western China, I really always, you know, got one of the things that I always absorbed was just how much a huge number of regular people truly believed in the system that was set up for them, despite all of its repression and despite the bizarre cult of personality around the Kim dynasty, you know, just the bizarre, just the things that happen there, they're so alien to us. But when you've grown up with it, when that's the system that, you know, that's all you've known, you had no contact with the outside world, very little contact, that's going to be your rational reality. And you're going to make, you know, you're going to think and make decisions within the framework of that reality that's around you. That's one of the reasons why North Korea has succeeded and survived for so long, despite repeat attempts that the people would somehow rise up and topple it or change the government. And this is the same for, you know, many parts of China. There are some parts of China in the East where, you know, maybe people have traveled a bit more, they've grown up with the internet. It's still heavily censored, but they might have a stronger worldview of what's going on around them. But if you are, a Communist Party hardliner, you're rising up through the ranks of, you know, this very ruthless cutthroat party that historically has purged people, gotten rid of people, even killed people who it didn't like, that you are going to take on the ruthless cutthroat way of making decisions that is demanded of you. So a lot of this course of action, just to give some context, began with the rise of Xi Jinping, who is the president of China, so he came to power back in 2012 and 2013. He did away with, there was a previous generation of globalizing leaders who were bureaucrats, who were more, they were faceless bureaucrats who, you know, you didn't really see their personality much. They would come and go, shuffle in for 5 years or so, then they'd be gone. But he took that system and he turned it into his own personal, you know, cult of personality, more like what we've seen in a place like North Korea. You know, it's, you know, he's someone who's come and he's put his fingerprints on the party and on the nation. He's demanded more nationalism, more fervor, more righteous anger in the defense of China, which he sees as a nation that has been subjugated in the past and that needs to avenge past difficulties against foreign powers that continue to seek to subjugate it. This is his worldview, and this is how he sees the point that goes from China's own history to the point that, you know, he comes to now, having come into power. And he's very much the kind of person who would take this course of action against the Uyghurs, despite the irrationality, because he wants to find that common enemy. He wants to find the unifying other through which to build the great nationalism of the Chinese state. And so that's where this stands now. You know, a few terrorist attacks, the grenades, the attempted hijacking that failed, none of this would normally, you know, precede the creation of concentration camps and a total network of surveillance. It would usually be more even-handed, but that's not the case in China now, because that's not where China's historical experience stands under Xi Jinping.
And here's the big point/question here to editorialize for a second. I get really frustrated when folks who are skeptics of this story and folks who effectively are pushing the perspective that Chamath holds, when they basically frame this as about hawkishness or not hawkishness. So obviously, I could be very easily described as a China hawk. Given what you've said, you could be described as a China hawk. But what I don't see is I don't see literally anyone proposing to arm the Uyghurs or intervene in Western China. It really seems like people are importing parody versions of the 1990s and 2000s and acting as if that's what people are talking about right now. Because for me, the reason why we should care about this story, even though obviously there is nothing that can be done right at this moment to end the concentration camps, fix the digital surveillance. So much of this is internal, and that's very much a reality of where we live in today. When what matters to me here is, A, as you really catalog really helpfully in the book, this is a story that we shouldn't be optimistic about technology and the internet leading to societies being more open. They can literally lead to societies becoming more closed. B, this raises some very serious questions about how corporations themselves interact with these type of authoritarian regimes. And then C, finally, it brings to question a lot of the assumptions that undergirded our approach to China. You could ask all of these questions while entirely putting aside the idea that there will be any serious major intervention, because that's just not in the cards in any way whatsoever. So I'm curious, given my setup of why I think, beyond just the moral question, why this is deeply important, why people should care outside of the hawkish point. How do you think about this dynamic?
Yes, you're right. So geopolitically speaking, the reality is that Western China is not, it's not the hotbed of like major geopolitical interests that would prompt some kind of intervention or some kind of, actual armed activity. No one's talking about arming the Uyghurs, to draw a comparison, in the past, people have talked about arming, say, the Kurds, to fight against regimes there, including the American government and other governments. That's not only America's plan. But when it comes to China, I don't think that we're going to see much concrete action around what's happening with the Uyghurs. It is good that governments are declaring this a genocide, because that necessitates the demand. I mean, it creates the necessity that these governments will have to ratchet up sanctions against human rights abusing officials. They will have to withdraw their diplomats and boycott the Olympics, because you can't be involved at that high of a level with a government that you've accused of committing a genocide. It's just not possible on the international stage. When people talk about an intervention, or America's trying to commit some kind of imperialist Iraq, or there's going to be another war, another invasion, the mistake they're making is that they're only looking at the West and America, and they're drawing the wrong assumption that, what happens in America is what defines what happens around the world, that the world is somehow reacting to, what America does. I think that these critics, I don't think they're often very well versed in what's happening in China. I think that they're a little too insular into Western politics, whereas, no matter what America did, there's a strong likelihood that the Uyghur genocide would be happening regardless, or genocides against other groups. The fact of the matter is that, China is a large, very sophisticated global power that is interconnected to the economy. And regardless of that, it has still, continued on in committing these mass atrocities against one ethnic group, whether or not any other country was there, or whether or not the CIA was setting up a conspiracy, or whatever it might be. The fact of the matter is that China has its own agency, its own leaders are making their own decision, and it's not like they pick up the phone and ask what America's up to and then decide to commit the genocide against the Uyghurs because of that.
It's kind of funny. You're getting at the contradiction that captures a lot of, let's just say, real foreign policy skepticism. I'm not going to just be unfair and just smear the left here, which is that on the one hand, they want a multipolar world where the U.S. has diminished superpower status, can't intervene in the way that it does. In many respects, we're getting a world that looks much more like the world that they would like to live in. However, a result of that situation is the pendulum is swinging. Therefore, the U.S. will, by definition, have less agency and other people will have more agency, too. So it's very, and this is why I really hate discussing this conversation along the lines of just empire and imperialism, because it because a large part of it just misses the point. I also don't like, and I'm curious how you think about this, I don't like the invocation of history and the way it's used. So, for example, there's a lot of whataboutism on this topic. So there's a lot of, well, because it's actually interesting when you were describing what they are doing with Uyghurs in terms of trying to forcefully integrate them into the population, I thought, well, you know, like that's actually a lot like what the Australians tried to do with the Aboriginals for much of the 20th century. But it seems to me the obvious conclusion here is not to say, well, a Western ally of the United States also did this really mass terrible project. Canada has done these terrible things with Native Canadians. I guess that's the term in that example. And the U.S. did the same thing with Native Americans, because the obvious point is those are bad things. We should acknowledge those things. But you should ask yourself, how does bringing that up help us resolve any of the questions that are raised by this specific issue? So how do you think about history, whataboutism, and those different dynamics?
I would consider myself a whataboutism expert at this point. Like, I could totally get a PhD in whataboutism and go on about this topic for just for days. Because one of my favorite things is, you know, after writing this book, I really do enjoy going back through historical, you know, news and documentation and books and looking at all the examples of whataboutism I could find. And one of the first major, it was in 1954, it was the Soviet invasion of Hungary. This was an act that deeply divided the left between the more revolutionary socialist communist left and the more moderate leftist of the time. And this is the original invasion that created the word tanky, kind of the pejorative word for these revolutionary leftists who, you know, they proclaim their great principles of equality and equity and democratic socialism, but then in practice they end up siding with, you know, terrible, ruthless regimes, thinking that somehow those regimes are, you know, just the victims of American imperialism and they're only trying to set up their own, you know, their own wonderful paradise, and if only America would get out of the way, that would solve everything. So this line of thinking, I bring up history because I don't think that the intellectual kind of philosophy, I don't think I'd call it a philosophy, but kind of the intellectual framework around this kind of revolutionary left thinking, it hasn't evolved much since the Cold War. It really is a Cold War creation with the dilemma that leftists have when they back, you know, a major Soviet or an authority, you know, a power that they think is going to turn out to be great, and then it turns out to be worse than, you know, the many of the democratic Western states that they're so, you know, opposed to. They're opposed to liberalism and opposed to, I guess, liberal capitalism, these principles. And so the same thing is happening now with the Uyghurs. We're seeing this problem, this kind of logical conundrum they run into, where, you know, I remember it was back in the 90s and 2000s. There were many people, both on the center left and the far left in particular, who were saying that, you know, China is merely coming out of, you know, an age of repression. It was the victim of the Cold War, the victim of colonial meddling in the past. You know, they've tried to enact communism, but they failed. They had the Cultural Revolution, all that violence, but it's not their fault because they were merely the victims. They're just trying their best to make this better. And the line of thinking goes that in the 90s and 2000s, they were simply rising out of a time of oppression by the West and showing their true strength and prosperity and showing that their system, this sort of, you know, hybrid socialist capitalist system, you know, showing that it works, that it has promise. That was the big, you know, it made a lot of people excited. They were like thinking, wow, so, you know, a formerly communist government that's, you know, still communist on paper, they can succeed and this is going to be great. But now that that narrative has started to fall apart, I think that a lot of people on the far left in particular are clinging to, you know, whatever they can to show that, you know, China has it right, that China is just, they're the victim, and that, you know, they're, we should just try to understand them better. They're doing everything they can. And if there's a Uyghur genocide, you know, it must be some kind of American plot or some kind of invention to become, to justify aggression against China. The problem here is the narrative. Like, the problem is that the narrative overpowers the facts, and some people just don't want to go back and reevaluate their thesis, you know, based on what new information has come out.
And it's fascinating because given the framework here, it seems that what's happening is that there are people on the far left who seem, because these tend to be the folks who are doing the most of the, let's just say, like, denialism around this topic. They're so desperate for China to serve as a check on American hegemony that they have to just construct this, like, ridiculous conspiracy theory filled dynamic here when, like, look, like, you're getting what you want. Like, the point is, the conversation around the Uyghurs is not even the conversation around Tibet in the 1990s. Like, this is such a given in terms of China's hegemony, in terms of how China's been able to expand into Hong Kong, in terms of the skepticism around the U.S. relationship to Taiwan right now. You're getting the lack of American hegemony. You don't need to construct this excuse for China. So I think that's just the real frustrating thing, because as I'm just thinking, I'm just realizing you're getting what you want in terms of the status quo. No one's going to invade China. The U.S. couldn't pull off an Iraq war the way it could even 20 years ago. Accept that. And don't excuse genocide. Honestly, you don't even have to comment on it. I think that's the weird part for me. So as we're nearing the end here, let's actually talk to the, let's try to get past the whole "we can't do anything" bit, because that tends to lead to unproductive areas. So number one, what is being done? What's on the table? And what are the choices we have? That's a lot of things thrown into one, but basically, like, where do we go from here and where should we go from here?
Yes. So there is actually a lot that we can do. You know, maybe we can't outright stop the human rights atrocities completely, but there's a lot we can do that will make China respond and, you know, maybe ease up on its repression. The thing that we have to remember, I think, you know, a lot of people tend to forget this, is that China is not some, you know, crackpot dictatorship on a Caribbean island somewhere where, you know, there's this one, you know, ruler who's just smoking cigars all day and selling cocaine who won't respond to foreign pressure. Those kinds of regimes, you know, they're just their own fiefdoms, and they often don't respond to anything. Whereas in the case of China, this is a highly sophisticated regime that oversees and that regulates multiple multinational corporations. Many Chinese technology firms are some of the most valuable in the world and are deeply interconnected with the global economy. Chinese officials are, the top people there, even at the local level, the top people, they have accounts, they have assets all over the world. They have properties in France. They have a lot that is at risk. And there's one of the reasons, I believe, why China gets so upset when people expose its human rights abuses. It's not just because they're defending China out of patriotism. It's because, you know, if that official gets sanctioned, you know, all their assets are going to be frozen in America, Canada, France, you know, Switzerland, wherever it might be. You know, they are at huge risk. They know that what they're doing really either completely violates or really pushes the boundaries of international law. And it only takes, you know, a few activists and, you know, angry lawmakers to get the ball rolling and to start to pressure them and act against them. So the first major area where we have made a good deal of progress is sanctions on individuals and entities. This is one of the most immediate things that any country can do. Because it's very totalizing. It's like, you know, if the U.S. sanctions, say, so there's a paramilitary group called the Bingtuan, and this is the group that sort of organizes many of the you know, many of the atrocities in Xinjiang. So the U.S. government has sanctioned this group, and many other governments have too. And this is one of the most immediate, you know, one of the most forceful immediate things you can do, because, you know, this entity has major assets all over the world, and immediately with effect, all those assets are no longer in its control. And now, you know, you have this giant kind of paramilitary group in China that now has to figure out how it's going to pay its employees, how it's going to, you know, continue its operations. How is it going to keep these camps going? If we cut off the source of the funds, then that is, you know, maybe one third of the battle, and that will certainly help. It won't solve everything. One of the other things we can do, you know, the symbolic actions, China does respond to symbolic acts against it. So boycotting the Olympics, that does upset China, but that is the kind of thing that it does not, like, Chinese officials don't look at that and they think, let's keep violating human rights. Like, I believe that they actually do have, you know, conversations about what they're doing, and there are debates within the Communist Party about what is permissible and when they should stop. And there's evidence for this, but I won't go into that now. The other thing, you know, so one of the things that this is one of the more distant proposals, but if China would somehow, and this is perhaps unrealistic, but if China would somehow become a member of the International Criminal Court, which it is not, or would somehow be subject to the jurisdiction of the court, I think you have to be a member to be subject to its jurisdiction, then numerous top officials there, probably including the president himself, Xi Jinping, would be a potential criminal suspect for crimes against humanity and genocide. And that in itself, you know, would be the major step to holding people accountable.
And going before the international, need to be fair here too. The U.S. isn't a member of the ICC either.
No, it's not. It's not. And that is true. The U.S. is not. If it were a member, you know, that would open up the U.S. officials to you know, criminal charges for, you know, for things that they've done.
There'd be some Iraq war questions, obviously.
There would be Iraq war questions, Afghanistan questions, and, you know, there would be other questions. People like Henry Kissinger, you know, might be, you know, it's not very hard to file a complaint against the criminal court. And, you know, if you can find that, that's the thing, is that it does have very broad jurisdiction in this case. So, yes, I mean, if there were a way to better apply international law to, you know, to Chinese authorities, that would be one way of solving this problem. But that's very unrealistic at this stage. So I'm not sure if that will happen.
So here's the final question. Let's put our most empathetic slash problematic hats on and just think about this from China's perspective. What should China do? So as we've established, and you get into this more in your book, there was and is Uyghur Western Chinese separatism. I don't expect China, just as I wouldn't want the U.S. to break up, I don't expect China to want to break up territory it already literally controls within its borders. There were mass knife attacks. There were these hijackings. All that said, this seems to be, especially when it comes to the Olympic boycotts, I don't see a world where China gets another Olympics, the international hits to their reputation. It doesn't seem to be worth the price that they've had to pay. So what should China do? Or what do you think they will do moving forward, given the shifting sets of incentives and the real implications to their dynamics here, which is that it seems that what's happening with Western China, good luck with Taiwanese reunification. Good luck with your broader objectives. Good luck with Belt and Road. Good luck with your already precarious relations with Muslim countries worldwide. What do you think they will do in a best case scenario?
So I think that they'll continue what they're doing in a best case scenario, which is not keeping all the camps open. There has been more recently a trend of the Chinese authorities removing people from the camps, which were very overcrowded, and diversifying the oppression. So, you know, now more people are working in forced labor. Now they're working in, you know, factories. Now they're undergoing a formal trial and being charged with crimes and put in prison that way instead of going the extrajudicial route through the concentration camps. And I think that, you know, best case scenario is that, you know, I'm just speaking based on our circumstances now, is that they just start realizing that these camps don't work, that they're not solving the problem, that they're going to potentially radicalize far more people who might, you know, wage war on China, jihad at some point. But at the same time, I do have to, you know, I have doubts about that too, because even in Afghanistan, the Taliban has announced that, you know, it intends to be an ally and cooperate with China, that it's not going to, you know, it's not going to wage any kind of jihad or fight in China. That's not going to be its focus. And, you know, it's just, you know, it's like you look at that situation and it just seems so bizarre when you think about it. You think that a jihadist would want China to be their prime target because it's an atheist regime and, you know, it's supposedly decadent and more capitalist, but that's not the case. So with all
everyone
I've said,
has had to, you know what I'm realizing, and this is kind of more morbid, but the reality is that after the war on terror and the long wars of the past 20 years, it seems that everyone has decreased their ambitions.
Yeah.
At every single level. Like, this isn't Osama bin Laden declaring war on the West in 1997. This isn't the US affecting regime change or thinking the Chinese are going to change internally. It's really just everyone trying shifting to a much more, this much more grounded and realist world. And that has positives and that has negatives to it.
Yes. And I also think that, you know, most countries who were involved in the long wars of the past 20 years, they're now more inward looking. They're turning inward and they're saying, you know, why don't we just focus on what's at home, you know, especially with the tumult of recent history. And, you know, why worry about what's happening in China? This is one of the reasons why, you know, it could be hard to get people interested in the Uyghurs or the Chinese threat. So, you know, with all that, I think that the world will look a little more isolationist for the time to come. We already are seeing the decoupling of global economies, the US and China in particular, the decoupling, more importantly, I believe, of major technological ecosystems. China effectively operates on its own heavily censored ecosystem for all its people that's being exported to its own allies versus, you know, the Western dominated, more open ecosystem of Google and Amazon and those companies. So, you know, with all that, that's one of the things that, you know, worries me when it comes to genocide, is that in the end, will enough people care to want to do something about it beyond only the sanctions? Like, are the sanctions going to be the last straw for, you know, politicians who now feel more grounded and realistic about what's possible in the world? And it just worries me that they might give up. They might say, you know, human rights doesn't matter overseas. Democracy should not be our priority. We just have to focus on doing what's best at home and not worry about what's happening in China.
And a quick thing, though, and not really pushing back against you, but I'm just pushing back against the framing of, and this is going to sound super off-brandly, super anti-populist, but I don't think it really matters what individual people in the West, in the United States, think about this question. Because as with most foreign policy questions, foreign policies are least democratic, you know, small d democratic aspect. What matters, and this is also an excuse that that people who dismiss the genocide for a variety of reasons and that people who support the Chinese regime do, which is, look, what matters is how a CEO of a company personally feels about their decision to source parts from Western China. It matters whether Elon Musk thinks it's a good idea to open a showroom there. It matters how the US federal government and how the US Senate and House respond to these questions. It matters if a person at Disney decides to thank Western Chinese police officers in the credits for Mulan. Like, those are pushing this out to asking what everyday people think is just a, it's just a really, it's totally irrelevant. And it's just ultimately an excuse. If you'd asked people what Americans thought about Nazi Germany in the 1930s, not to overuse the World War II example, we just had a show where it was pointed out that it somewhat limits discussion by just focusing on this one very specific example. But the point is that throughout American history, asking what people think about these types of questions has not been a particularly useful dynamic. If you'd asked Americans, would you fight for slavery against slavery in 1860, the answer would obviously be no for a variety of reasons. So we need to take what you're saying around responsibility, the supply chains, the individual decisions by corporations and politicians, and put the responsibility there, not with an average person on the street during the third year of COVID, asking them to take a very complicated position on Western Chinese affairs. I think it's just, it's very irresponsible and bad. And you weren't doing this, but I just hate when people do that, because it's a willful misunderstanding of how foreign policy works.
Oh, yes, I agree completely. I think one of the big weaknesses, or one of the big problems that we face now, is the lack of elite consensus around human rights and democracy around the world. Particularly now, we're seeing this play out in Xinjiang. So in the past, you know, I think that the American people, you know, regular people, as we're talking about, were sold this narrative that, you know, that free trade is good, that we should, you know, open up with China, become their partner, outsource, supply our components from there, and this will be good. It's a win. They always say win-win situation. That's the old cliche of the guys in the suits. And you know, they thought that it would open up China to liberalism and a democracy somewhere down the line. That it, you know, maybe it would make America more prosperous with the you know, access to cheaper markets that would help businesses here, help small businesses grow in particular. Looking back, that narrative, I think it's one of the worst narratives, one of the worst storylines that we've been sold of the 21st century. And historians one day are going to look at that, and they're just going to say, like, what were these people thinking? That is one of the most ridiculous things I've ever heard. What has happened is the opposite, that we have entered a situation where you know, our elites are so dependent on Chinese capital, Chinese production, Chinese manufacturing, Chinese market access, that they're becoming the willing, you know, the useful idiots of China, that they're willing to do what China says, and if China doesn't like it, they're not going to do that. So one of the reasons why so many multinational businesses are operating in Xinjiang and have refused to even bring up the genocide happening in Xinjiang in interviews, it's because they know, you know, that if they say anything about this, and, you know, even if they don't say anything, even if they remove their presence in Xinjiang or remove their, you know, their involvement in the supply chains of Xinjiang, that will signal to the Chinese Communist Party that they're not willing to go along with the official line, and that's going to destroy their market access across China, not just in Xinjiang. And in their mind, that is a nightmare scenario, because they're going to have to scramble to figure out the future of their business since it's so dependent on China. So we have this now, this lack of elite consensus. You know, we're going through this really strange phase where people are denying genocide. Powerful business leaders who have everything they could dream for in the world, they're not standing on the side of people who are suffering. They're giving up the values of a democracy, the values of, you know, liberty and freedom and equality of all people, for the sake of their own little Chinese market access. And, you know, I think maybe the consensus will arrive eventually. You know, there, I think there are different factions among the American business and political elite who are still waging, you know, this war of rhetoric and figuring out, you know, how things are going to sort out in the end. But my biggest worry is that we, you know, we as Americans, our leaders make a decision that we need to protect the market access of our businesses over the fundamental rights of all peoples.
Very well said. Great place to leave it. Jeff, would love you to quickly shout out The Perfect Police State as a great intro to the topic for a bunch of people from a lot of really different angles. Especially, I really have to highlight this again, the explanation of the technology angle that we didn't get into as much here.
So thank you for having me, Marshall. Yeah, so the book is called The Perfect Police State, an undercover odyssey into China's terrifying surveillance dystopia of the future. And it's specifically about the technology angle, how technology was used to create the real life George Orwell dystopia that the sci-fi novelists of past days once predicted. That is what the book is about.
Listeners will know my verbal tick is that I say last question, but then I have another question that comes up here. Word undercover. And if you're listening to this on audio, not watching on YouTube, you'll see that Jeff is a white, very Caucasian looking Western man. You've got a beard, reddish brown hair. How does the word undercover fit into Western China? I gotta ask.
Okay, so it doesn't mean I'm putting on a mask and trying to look like I'm
a really cringe image of like 1930s inappropriate Hollywoodism, but yeah, please.
Yeah, some kind of inappropriate, like, you know, maybe putting on a uniform and like a fake mustache or something. Yeah, no, it doesn't mean.
Yeah.
So what it means is that when I was doing my research in Western China, I was always posing as a tourist. I was not talking, like going up to local people and trying to talk to them. I was always there just observing, jotting down notes, kind of secretly trying to take photos where I could. And then when I had to leave China, I was detained. Like all of us are all foreign journalists have been detained there a few times. And I ended up leaving. I ended up moving to Turkey and I decided to immerse myself among the Uyghur community there. I didn't go around in that case. I guess that was when the undercover element ended. I didn't go around advertising myself as a journalist writing a book about the Uyghurs, but very quietly, you know, through my own Uyghur networks with the help of my own Uyghur translator, a man named Abdueli Ayub, who's a professional linguist of the Uyghur language, I was able to kind of use the whisper networks and to find the right people who had the right internal access within the Chinese system to try to excavate what was actually going on inside. This also, I should just add that this was not just a book where I wanted to go around interviewing victims and hearing the victim stories. You know, those are obviously very important, but I wanted to construct an image of, you know, how a system like this can be set up from the inside and how it can become so effective and even out of control, how it you know, that the people who create it lose control of it in the Frankenstein tradition and it becomes this monster that consumes all. And I was able to get to some of the very rare you know, people who don't speak often, so some of the technology workers, some of the insiders who had worked for these Chinese technology firms who were directly involved in building the surveillance systems. So that was the goal. And that was the undercover element, was that I was very, very low key and I was not, you know, going around making a big deal of this. I didn't even mention it until the publication date was set. I mean, it was probably 3 months before publication that my publisher actually announced it.
Wow, that's a good actual place to end. Jeff, thank you so much for joining us on The Realignment.
Thanks, Marshall. Good to talk to you.
Reminder, Substack, subscription, bookshop, book purchases, and of course, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. We'll see you next time.